agenda there. To start out with, we're going to start today with a discussion about costs and how the price of healthcare, I guess, or the cost of healthcare is determined in different settings. I think it's at least for me personally, it's been one of the questions that's been really, I've struggled with a lot as we deal with a lot of these other issues. This concept keeps returning to my head, at least, and so I thought it would be helpful to us to look at that side of the equation as we kind of move toward figuring out what are different ways to make healthcare more affordable.
If I could, just before we start, by way of explanation, so everyone on this working group doesn't think we're just completely and totally disjointed and disconnected from one week to the next. The assignment that we gave to the Department of Human Services to cost out the discussion that we had at our last meeting, they would not be able to start working on it until this week because they've been working on the forecast. And so we will return to that discussion probably at our next working group meeting when we have that data and that information. So we haven't just forgotten about it.
Yeah. So the discussion being the what's affordable insurance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And to that point, just to reference people, in the packets, there is one of the things on affordability, and this is for a future discussion, but just to take a look at one of the ways of looking at affordability is kind of look what do people spend for everything else and what's left over as a way to kind of assess what could be affordable for healthcare. And that's one of the techniques Massachusetts used, if you recall. And this last sheet in the packet, which is a spreadsheet of sorts, uses Minnesota data from Jobs Now Coalition, the work that they've done to assess, you know, what typical costs are for a variety of things. And it may just give us a little bit of guidance. So between now and the next meeting, you might want to just take a glance at it. It's actually very revealing in particular about the geographic variations in the costs of everything other than healthcare. And what's left over for people living in northwest Minnesota is a lot different than what is left over, for instance, in the metro area. So anyway, that's there for the next round of discussions. But it did provide a little bit of, I thought, interesting insights on that. Well, why don't we get started with the cost discussion? And Karen Pete, I guess, from DHS is going to give us we're going to start with a discussion of how the department negotiates public rates with plans. Thank you.
My name is Karen Pete. I'm from the Minnesota Department of Human Services, and I work in the Managed Care Purchasing and Development Division. We have a number of different groups that we purchase for, and so I can talk a little bit about each one because each one has some special considerations. For the PMAP, which is essentially families and children, and includes Minnesota Care, we look at a variety of variables in setting the rates. We look at health plan revenues and expenditures on Minnesota healthcare programs. So on the population that we're setting rates for, we look at what we paid them and what they spent. For a three-year period prior to the year that we're setting rates for. We're setting rates for 2008 right now, and we're using the three-year period from January 2004 through December 2006. We look at the health plan financials that are submitted to the Department of Health or Commerce, which gives us the most complete information that they have at the end of each one-year period. At that point, though, that information is submitted at the end of March. It's due the 1st of April. So they haven't always paid all of the claims for the preceding year. So we would supplement the financial information every year with a request for additional information in about July, August, asking for more claims run out. So is there additional experience that informs what you submitted to when you submitted your financial? You know, did you overestimate the number of claims that were out there and not paid, or underestimate? Did something change? Did you break in? Did you make more money or lose more money than you projected? So that's the supplemental information that we get. We take that information and we weight it so that the most current period has the heaviest weight. So if we're looking at a three-year period, the first year is worth 17%, the second is about 33%, and the most current period is about 50%. Split that however, it adds up to 100% with rounding. And so that means that if healthcare costs are trending up, the most recent period gets the heaviest weight. If they're trending down, then again, the most recent period would get the heaviest weight there. In addition to that, in the event that there are changes between the current changes in the current year that aren't reflected in, say we're looking at 2006, and let's say, for example, healthcare costs were trending down, but there's been some significant change that happened in 2007. We would ask them for the first 6 months of claims for 2007, and we ask for that about the end of August. So they're giving us the first 6 months of data about 8 months after that period starts. And so that would tell us if there's a big change in the direction of costs, and sometimes it might tell us something about a change in experience or maybe an impact of a change that we made in eligibility that we hadn't predicted correctly. We used to, many years ago, base our rates on the fee-for-service experience, but we don't do that anymore for families and children because there are very few people left in our fee-for-service program. Mm-hmm. They're mostly in managed care, and so we need to reference the health plan's experience in setting the rates. A concern that gets expressed and a concern that the department has is that to just ask the health plans, well, what did we pay you and what did you spend, has the potential to create an incentive to not manage the funds. And so we also look at a variety of other benchmarks to see what other information is out there. What was the rate of increase in healthcare costs over fee for service? Even though the population is different, we do look at what was the rate of increase. What was the rate of increase or decrease in Medicare spending? So we have other benchmarks that we look at, and we weight the health plan's experience, blend the weight of the health plan's experience with another benchmark that is not health plan specific. And that's to balance against the inclination not to manage costs. The other piece of information that we look at is healthcare risk for the families and children population. We have a system of risk adjustment that looks at what was the healthcare experience of each plan that has a contract with us. And we collect the encounter data for all of the enrollment for a one-year assessment period. And it's run through a grouper that essentially develops a healthcare value for each diagnosis or group of diagnoses. So if average cost or average health risk is 1, then we take all of the people that are enrolled in Plan A and we run their experience through the grouper, and the grouper assigns a weight that tells us that Plan A has a healthcare risk of, say, 1.2 or 1.4, and Health Plan B has a health risk of maybe 98%. They're 98% as sick as average. And then we would take that weight and multiply it against a base rate. And the way that under our current contract, plans are receiving 50% of their rates based on demographic, age, where they live, gender, all of those considerations, and 50% of their rate is based on the health risk of their population during a previous assessment period. We don't try to predict the health risk of a particular plan at a point in the future. We go back and say, what has your risk been in the past? And that's generally a little less risky, a little more risky maybe to the plans, a little less risky to the state or to the purchaser. And we are in the process now. We're using some old data. Our base rates for risk adjustment are based on old data, and we are rebasing right now, getting numbers out of the system this week to shift to a new grouper that better reflects new diagnosis codes and different practices in coding. And we'll be rebasing to a newer year of experience. We will reset the base rates and the averages to 1 and then readjust based on health plan experience.
What kind of limitations do you put on what the health plans can negotiate with providers in terms of rates or other standards?
We put very few limitations. Most of the places where we're real explicit about what plans can pay pertains to information that are instructions that are provided by the legislature. So if you tell us that there's a cost of living adjustment that needs to be made for the nursing home services that are part of our seniors contract, for example, we would say to the health plan, okay, we're going to put this 2% in and you're expected to pass it on. And so to the extent that you've done that for providers, say mental health, PCA, home care services in the Families and Children contract, that would also be considered in our rate process. I talked a little bit about setting sort of the first process that I talked about was sort of setting expected increase in medical trend and utilization. The other thing that we also look at is, are there any changes in eligibility and benefit that has been established by the legislature? And that's also a factor that plays in. And that's usually a very small proportion. Unless there's a really big change in eligibility or benefits, it's usually a small proportion of the rate change in any given year. For seniors, we have a number. Most of the seniors who are enrolled in managed care are dually eligible. Some of them are only eligible for medical assistance. The process that we use for those that are medical assistance eligible only is similar to the process that we use for families and children, except that we will, in 2008, no longer be risk adjusting that group. Seniors, for the most part, tend to move from Medicaid eligibility into dual eligibility. The bulk of the costs, the hospital, the physician, the drugs, are now in the Medicare program, and so we're really just paying for Medicaid services and coinsurance on Medicare for most of our dual eligibles. The population of seniors that are Medicaid only is very small and was no longer judged to be a good population to risk adjust. So that is the significant difference for seniors. For people with disabilities, the largest difference among that population right now is that we have a very small group enrolled in managed care and a very large group remaining in fee-for-service. And so we do look at fee-for-service experience in setting the base rates for the disability group. We're also looking at plan experience and doing some blending between fee-for-service and managed care experience. In launching the special needs basic care, we've looked heavily or relied heavily on the fee-for-service experience. We will be implementing a new risk adjustment process using a different grouper that's targeted to group services for people with disabilities.
Senator Berglund.
Ms. Pede, within our contracts for our elderly and to the extent we have disabled people in managed care, is it possible for us to have any flexibility about how the Medicare payments are made?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Berglund, we don't have direct responsibility for Medicare payments. When we started the MSHO demonstration, the Department of Human Services held the Medicare contract with CMS, and then we contracted with the health plans and, in essence, delegated that Medicare contract. And we had a little more control in that circumstance than we do now. With the rollout of Medicare Advantage on a national basis, CMS decided that they didn't want to have direct contracts with states for demonstrations anymore. They wanted the contract to be directly with the plans. So we don't have a great deal of influence on how I'm – if you have a specific question.
Well, for example, let's just take the favorite example that's being discussed in all of these meetings these days. Let's talk about heart disease. And if we decided that we wanted to encourage more involvement with nurse practitioners or with nurse case managers, and we wanted to pay for telephone consultations with the clients, and we wanted to pay for scales at home for obese patients, could we build that into a contract where you would generate then savings on the hospitalization side, but you might be changing the way you paid for services on what had otherwise been the Medicaid side?
Okay. I don't know that we can specifically dictate how services are paid on the Medicare side.
Let me ask the question another way then. Okay. If there were savings on the Medicare side, mm-hmm. in that example, would the state get to retain some or any of the savings?
Not to my knowledge at this time. We are working with that, and the example that you gave is...
Would the managed care plans retain the savings then?
Well, or the...
Or does Medicare at the federal level retain the savings?
Medicare at the federal level is looking at retaining as much of those savings as they can, and when plans submit their Medicare Advantage bids, if there are savings left over around the benchmark, then the plan needs to take 25% of what was left over and give that directly back to CMS, and then they take the other 75% and can reinvest that into services for their enrollees. And what Minnesota is looking at is how are we able to leverage how plans use those so that we see some of the savings on the Medicaid side. One of the concerns that we have in contracting is that we think that there's a lot of potential for generating savings and efficiencies, but we would like to see that the state sees some of the benefit of those efficiencies and not have it all go back to CMS. I feel like the CMS police are going to come and take me away for saying things like that. You know, I was going to talk a little bit or mention that your example is a good one, and it's the kind of thing that we are working with as we set either performance improvement projects or items that we want to – protocols that we want to implement for seniors. What we're looking at is how can we, in essence, use – care that's delivered on the Medicare side, on the Medicare dime, and generate savings on the Medicaid side. And so we're actively working with a group of representatives of health plans and their medical directors to develop some measures that would be intended to do that. Now, whether we'll be able to track that directly, I think, is uncertain. But that's part of the motivation. Part of the motivation is to deliver them the most effective care to people, but it's also to look at how can we leverage screening and other activity that would detect illness early and potentially prevent some of the larger costs on the deep end of the the scale.
So, Mr. Chairman and Ms. Peet, would it be possible for us, not today at this meeting, but to get a little bit more of a descriptive narrative of what those discussions are entailing?
I'm a little bit circumscribed by the fact that I'm supposed to be at this moment sitting across the negotiating table from a plan and negotiating contract that includes that information. So I think we could certainly provide it once contracts are signed. You know, there's kind of a cone of silence that comes down over contract negotiations. Let me go back and work with staff and work with the committee that's developing that and see what we can provide, because that's exactly, you know, the circumstance that you're alluding to, that there are Medicare dollars and how do we get some of the savings on the Medicaid side, is something that we're deeply concerned with.
Mr. Chairman, then along a different line of questioning, the Governor's Transformation Task Force has as their assignment a reduction of 20% of the costs in the healthcare delivery system. And if that, if recommendations are made for changes that would accomplish that, then how would you build those into your rates, since you have this prospective method of negotiating rates based on history?
Or to say it another way, how would you pull those savings out from
the
plans and providers?
Yeah. You know, one of the things that we do is, that I didn't mention, is to set a target for where we expect plans to be in terms of profitability and their overall retention of savings. And if we have overestimated that amount, if we, let's say we, how does this work? If we've underestimated it. So if we've expected that you are going to retain 0.5% of what we paid you to put back into reserves or interest-bearing accounts or wherever a health plan puts that money, if we said that you were going to earn 0.5% and in reality you earned 1.5%, we're going to go back and take our base rate for 2006, say, and true that up and say, well, now that we know more than we did when we negotiated the 2006 rates, we're going to back that down and take a percent out. So that's one way that we'd reflect experience. If we actually had to save 20% in the healthcare system as a whole, I think it would take quite a bit to save that amount of money. And I, you know, for very significant savings for the most part. I think there are things that you can do with care coordination and getting people in early before they become seriously ill and avoiding hospitalizations, avoiding nursing home placements, with the caveat that home care is also or can also be expensive. But to achieve a 20% reduction, it seems to me that we might be looking at something more along the lines of reduction of benefits or changes in eligibility, which...
Mr. Chairman, just so we can be clear, that isn't the charge. The charge isn't just to cut services, but to reduce the cost of the system.
Okay.
Because when you just cut services, you're just cost shifting. One of the things that I'm wondering about in regard to your response is that it just seems to me like having a prospective system. Well, let's just say, let's take the example of the 0.5% versus the 1.5%. At what point in time would you be taking that back out? Would you be taking it back out based on the next year's rate, or would you be taking it out based on the current year's payments?
We would be taking it out based on setting the base. So if we're looking, let's say we're including the year 2006 in our, as part of establishing the base, we'd say the base rate for 2006 was 1% too high, so we need to true up the system and lower it. So we won't pay you the 2006 rate that was too high. We're going to take it back down to, in looking at changes in healthcare cost and trend.
Mr. Chairman, but for that year, you paid 1% too much.
That's correct.
Going forward, you would not continue
correct
that calculation estimation that was in error, mm-hmm. but for that year you would have paid too much.
That's correct. And one of the things I think a number of health plans can tell you that DHS is getting better at getting there. The years when overall plans made 6% on the Medicaid program are gone. We're really much closer overall in our aggregate rate setting. An individual plan may make more money in a given year, and part of the way that we deal with that is to look at how have we set the geographic rates. Has healthcare experience changed in such that South Central Minnesota is no longer more expensive than Southeastern Minnesota, or has you know, are we seeing the relativity or the relative value or the relative costs expenditures in those area change? And we have to revise that at least every 5 years, or more frequently at the option of the state. One thing that we have not done, Senator, is to have any kind of risk sharing or benefit sharing with health plans. So, you know, in the scenario, the fictitious scenario for 2006, where we paid a percent too much, purchasers do sometimes have a window, and they'll say, okay, if you make an amount that's above the window, then we'll split that amount that's above with you 50-50 or 75-25, kind of like Medicare does, where they have said, okay, there's an amount left over, and Medicare gets 25% back, and you take the rest and put it back into the system. So it would be possible to negotiate some kind of agreement like that. Typically, though, and plans or others can speak to this, there's a desire for some tit for tat, if you will, and so if we lose more than 1%, then we want the state or the purchaser to bear 50% or 80% of that risk. And right now we have no sharing on the risk in our contracts with the plan. So if they lose 20% or 3%, it's entirely at their risk, and the state has no share in that.
Mr. Chairman, just one comment then, and then others can ask their questions. But it seems to me that under the way you negotiate rates with managed care plans, which is most of our population, that it always, any savings there are going to be will always show up in the forecast. And it makes a job of a group like this, where we're trying to identify savings and redirect them perhaps at other investments that need to be made or other expenses that would be part of an overall plan, makes it very difficult for us to reinvest the savings. Okay. If you have any suggestions for how we might try to think about that, I think we would appreciate it.
Okay.
Other questions? Pete.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I mean, I think this is a follow-up in part to Senator Bergman's question. And I guess I'm going to ask this in two parts, one for what's left of your fee-for-service population, and then secondly for the broader PMAP population. We had discussion this morning at the Full Access Commission, and Representative Thiessen's reading list, which got set out on physician compensation, in particular, talked about the mismatch between compensation for primary care physicians and compensation for specialty physicians. And this is just a example of issues out there. And needless to say, as when we talk about medical home or chronic care models, the provider community is more than happy to bring us suggestions about greater investment in primary care and positive changes in primary care fee schedules. And I happen to support that. They are much less willing to come to the table then and talk about compensating offsets elsewhere in the system. And the savings is kind of presented to us only as deferred services. And so while we will hopefully have primary care physicians making a bit more than they do now, the cardiologists and radiologists, et cetera, will continue to make what they're making now or make more. And I guess my question is, you know, where you control the fee schedule. I mean, have you thought about how to adjust that fee schedule so at the end of the day it's cost neutral? And then as you're talking with health plans on their PMAC products, have you had discussions with them that if we are to improve compensation for certain types of providers, we expect them to be able to deliver offsetting changes elsewhere in their fee schedules with their provider groups?
To answer your second question first, Mr. Benner, because I know a little bit more about it. There are health plans that I've been in discussion with who do compensate primary care physicians higher and specialty physicians relatively lower. They are playing in the marketplace. They can't be entirely divorced from what's out there in the marketplace, but they are reducing the gap. And, you know, the only way I can think that they're doing that is either by people not getting to the specialists. And I think that there used to be, that used to be the concern that people, or one of the concerns that people had about managed care plans. I think that's less true. So I have to conclude that they're actually doing some reduction on the specialist side of the equation. But I don't have a lot of specific detail about that. I can just think of a couple of conversations that I've had with health plans that are making an effort to do that. On the fee-for-service side, I think that we are in the process of looking at a relative value scale for our compensation, but I am not the right person to answer your question. If you want me to take it back, I can certainly do that and send some information.
Thank you.
What? Just a couple of other questions. When you talked about profitability, are you looking at just the public program profitability?
I actually didn't even call it profitability. I called it contribution to reserves, but it's what's left over at the end of the day. And we typically we're in a nonprofit market. We had to sort of make a decision about what was a reasonable amount for health plans to have left over. We had to assume that if they had money left over, they'd be able to invest that and earn some money that could go into reserves or profit or a financial margin of some kind. And so we typically are looking at trying to get the plans to manage to somewhere between break-even and a 1% margin.
And when you and just to kind of follow up on Senator Berglund's question, just so I understand it, between the half and the 1%, then if trend is at 5% in a particular year, and they were about a percent over there, between the half and the 1.5%, you would maybe give them a 4% the following year instead of the 5% at trend. I mean, that's very simple in a very simplistic.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, what we do is we basically say, here's the time period that we're going to adjust at. You know, here's the 17% of the weight, and here's the 33% of the weight, and here's the 50% of the weight. The 50% of the weight is the most recent complete set of data that we have, and it's always a little bit unknown because claims can come in for a period of time. Experience can change. So it's mostly that the first 50% where we would have made an adjustment, say, okay, we paid too much then. So we're going to reset the base to a lower base rate, and then so instead of adding
okay
so the trend this year is 4%, we're only going to give you 3. Instead of doing that, we say, well, actually the base was too big, because you don't want to leave extra money in the base, you want to take it out. And then trend on the smaller number. So that's how we do it.
Okay, and then that's helpful, thank you. And then the on the care coordination and all the things that health plans are doing to, you know, save money in a sense, what's your perception on whether that actually gets back to the state?
I think the place where we have the most potential to save money is in the population that are using long-term care services. And so if we look at MSHO in particular, which is the group that we've had the most experience with, the largest experience with, we do find that our rates on those long-term care services overall are, you know, there are greater efficiencies when you put it all into an integrated product and manage it that way. So with the Medicare, the Medicaid, and the waiver services in a single project there, or product managed through a single entity, there do seem to be efficiencies when compared to fee-for-service. I had a thought.
That's fine. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Berglund. Karen, thanks for your presentation. Just a note on the care management part. When we were talking about the cardiovascular disease programs, things like congestive heart failure or coronary artery disease management, those are some of the most well-developed programs mm-hmm. we have, and our state public programs members have access to that care within the plans. Most of the days reduction in days per thousands have probably come from some of those things like scales at home, or the primary care services in the long-term care facilities. And as Karen has said, the opportunity to integrate it with Medicare and Medicaid probably works best. But even in the cases where there are Medicaid members or Medicare-only members, they're getting that same level of service in those long-term care facilities or the same access today to those disease management programs. So whether we'd see additional savings or there's opportunity to really drive down costs with more days per thousand reduced, you know, these programs have been around a long time, and we're doing better than most other places in the country as a result of that. So that may not be necessarily the best place to look for mm-hmm. additional savings. There could be other areas, perhaps. And then secondly, on kind of how you come out at the end of the day, the programs are rated differently. So your relative success in terms of a margin or not may depend on your mix of general assistance to prepaid medical assistance to Minnesota Care members, with general assistance being if you have a higher mix in general of those members, you're probably not going to do very well because that program always operates at a loss.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Berglund, you've reminded me, thank you, of a point that I wanted to make earlier in talking about how might we make changes in the healthcare system to reduce costs. And one of the things that we are looking at relates directly to the kind of cardiac care models that Zimmerman is talking about. We have had individual health plans going out and making individual determinations or plan-by-plan determinations about performance improvement projects and those kinds of activities. And one of the things that I found when I started attending different sets of meetings and talking directly with providers is that's one source of irritations, putting it mildly, driving doctors nuts is probably closer to the truth. If we have 9 different PMAP health plans we don't ever have 9 in a clinic, but sometimes we have 5. If we have 5 different health plans in a clinic, each with a different priority on what kind of performance they're trying to improve, it means that nobody's paying much attention to any of those 5 projects. And so coming together as a community to sort of agree on how we might measure the activity that we're engaged in, what kinds of strategies we might engage in to change physician practice, I think is a place that's ripe for exploration there. We are working with the Bridges to Excellence group on diabetes measures and cardiac measures now for the managed care plans, and we're using the same measurement on the fee-for-service side so that the providers all understand that there's one standard that we are measuring to across the population, whether we're Minnesota healthcare programs or uh, 3M. You know, we've all agreed on what the measure is, and these are things that we want to do that are essentially having you change your practice. And so the change in practice, I think, probably occurs, I've always thought this, at the the provider level. And so you need to get in at the clinic level and have some consensus about how we're going to treat all the patients that come in our door, or at least the standard that we're going to keep in mind in treating diabetic patients that come in our door. And then we make individual decisions based on individual cases about how we're going to vary from that. But at least we know what the standard is or the goal that we're trying to attain. And I think that that is an area that, as I say, is ripe for exploration. Diabetes and cardiac care are two areas that are where the evidence is very well developed. And so the struggle, I think, will be to come up with enough evidence-based activity to create the incentives.
And from the perspective of the state, though, negotiating through the health plans with the providers, where do we put the responsibility for those evidence-based, whether they're outcomes or processes? Is our leverage with the health plans to say if your patient group is not meeting these kind of levels, there's going to be penalties or bonuses? It seems like we're one step removed that discussion.
I think our leverage is with the health plans, and then the health plans have leverage with the providers. In the fee-for-service world, we have a direct leverage with the providers. We have measures where the metric is the same. And we'll see if there's a difference in production, if you will, in change. When we're at one point incenting at the clinic level and in another in the fee-for-service program incenting at the direct provider level. You know, it's not a research study, but it's constructed in such a way that we may be able to draw some conclusions.
Well, Representative Huntley had a question.
Well, my questions are pretty much the same as yours, Mr. Chair and Ms. Pete. How do you build in, when you're negotiating with the plans and we have these quality measures, do you build in, or obviously there has to be some measurement of what's happening, and then is there a cash reward that they get if they meet goals, or we just ask them to meet it? Senator Berglund always talks about the measuring lead in kids. You know, what's the percentage?
There's a withhold on that.
Yep.
Is that part of the negotiation, and are there cash rewards to the plans that do better?
Representative Huntley, we do have two kinds of constructs in the contract. One is a withhold, where we actually hold back 5% of the capitation, and if they meet targets, they can get some or all of that 5% back. The problem is that we're so near to the bone that if anybody loses a couple of percent, we could be driving them, you know, into a very bad financial position. So we do have the capacity to withhold if they fail to meet targets. We also have identified some measures where we've set the rates based on your experience, and your experience is that 30% of the people came in for this kind of service, and we really want you to get from 30% to 80%. Under our rate-setting model, if you're really successful and you get 75% of the people in, so you've had a 45% increase in whatever that preventive care might be, or whatever the increase is in maintaining people in good diabetic control, you've probably spent more in, you may have saved something on hospitalization, but you've probably spent more on the preventive care than we paid you for. And so we do have some incentive programs that are at this point in the contract tied to QCare measures, where we can say if you're at 30% and you get your target is 80%, if you achieve 10% of the gap there, so if you make a 5% increase in the number of people that get these services, we will pay you an amount. So we do have an incentive program out there. We have a number of incentives in the contract, and there is a plea for us to focus them. And so we're looking at that to focus them on areas so that, and again, to the extent that you are, and this was a reason for selecting the QCare measures, to the extent that you're all talking about the same measures that everybody is talking about, then at least we know what we're measuring. And I think where the difference is that in some, to serve some of the people that we serve, you need to take additional steps. It's beyond just getting me in the door. You know, there may be interpreter services. There may be a need to provide a community health worker to explain why I want you to come in and have this service done, because in Somalia, where you came from, you didn't go near the hospital unless you were sick, because that's where people go to die. So, you know, all of those things come into it, and so there may also be administrative expense associated with that. And that's why we don't ask the plans to wait 3 to 5 years to see the difference in the rates on that change.
Senator, Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Pede, I had another question, probably doesn't relate to negotiating, but probably just the people that are in PMAP and Minnesota Care. It just seems to me that the per person spending in Minnesota Care is considerably higher than you would expect if they were compared to state employees' families. Are people that are in those two programs, are they sicker than the general population? And I guess the first question is, are we spending more on them than a population of employed people? Are they sicker? Do we know that? Or are they just going to the doctor more often?
Representative Huntley, I don't have a good answer to that question. I can certainly go back and look at our risk scores. I don't have the health risk scores for state employees, for example. I do know that in some respects the Minnesota Care benefit set, Medicaid benefit set in Minnesota is richer and covers more things than my benefit set as a state employee, and probably also than yours. So that's one issue. Another issue is that many people come to Minnesota Care having not had insurance, perhaps for as short a period as 4 months, but perhaps for a longer period. They may be people that were otherwise unable to get insurance. Maybe their employers stopped covering employees because of expenses associated with me and my family, for example. You know, and that might mean that I was the straw that broke the camel's back as far as my employer even purchasing health care insurance. And so I think that people who can go bare sometimes do, and they can go not covered with health insurance because they're not particularly sick. I think the people who come to our programs, and particularly I would say the adults, it may be that they have a particular need that they want to get covered. In my personal social circle, I know people who have Minnesota Care insurance for their kids who either don't qualify for coverage themselves or who choose not to cover themselves, and they're just hoping they stay reasonably healthy and until they get old enough for Medicare. So if they were spending a lot of money on doctors and health care, they probably would see if they were able to be covered. So I think there's that piece.
Well, Mr. Chair and Ms. Pede, if you could just get me some data on what the spending per person is in those two programs. But I think the seniors and long-term care is a completely different group, and there's probably no outside group to compare it to. But are they sicker? Are we spending more? Would be of interest to me. My guess is that if you're 55 years old and don't have health insurance and you're healthy, you're less concerned about it than if you're 55 years old and happen to have a chronic illness.
Exactly.
So there certainly is some risk selection in our current system.
I will get you the per-person spending. That's for PMAP and Minnesota Care.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Huntley, we need to remember that Minnesota Care is a community-rated, no underwritten product. And that's not true in the commercial individual market. So while I think the per-person costs in Minnesota care are higher than you would see for an individual product in the marketplace. It is not higher than the average per-person cost in the state employee benefits. The COBRA cost for a state employee today are $440 a month per person. That's higher than the cost of Minnesota care per person. But the reason is because state employees tend to be an older group of people. The reasons Minnesota care is higher than the individual market is because it's a community rated, no underwriting in the benefit design. And I know there are people in my district that when they become older and if they're in MSHA and they feel they can afford to take the benefit set in Minnesota care, they will shift over because they can't afford the premiums in MSHA. We saw that chart at our last meeting. I mean, if you're over 45, it's over $1,000 a month. So obviously, you know, you might be concerned about having coverage, but you might not be able to afford $1,000 a month. So then maybe you would shift into Minnesota care if you, income-wise, if you're eligible.
Follow up on Representative Huntley's question. I just wondered, will you be including GAMC in that Minnesota care households versus families and singles versus families and children? I mean, I remember back in 2003 that the profile of Minnesota care, we had charts then that talked about usage, and the one I remember, some of the profiles for individuals on Minnesota care looked more like GAMC usage than MA. So I just would be interested in also seeing GAMC.
And I can give you average spending, average payments for GAMC as well. There are, of course, the folks who start out on GAMC and move to Minnesota care.
Right,
so,
right.
I think we can track those separately.
I had one other question. When you were describing for families and children the process, you talked about, I'm not sure if I exactly followed that, did I understand it correctly that 50% is based on health risk? 50% is based on other factors. Is that correct? Kind of
correct. We have two sets of rates. We have a set of rates that says, in general, it costs so much per person per month to serve people who are of this age and gender and live in this part of the state and live in a nursing home or don't. You know, so there are a variety of demographic and age factors that we consider. And so we have a rate that says this is what we would pay. Then we have a base rate for risk adjustment that says if we were totally basing this on risk adjustment, we'd pay this amount. And then we pay half of the demographic rate and half of the risk-adjusted rate.
Feel that DHS has become more successful in reducing the old 6% that plans used to make. And so are you able to determine in any given year, are you better at the risk adjustment of the equation or the other 50%?
I would have to go back and look at the last several years. I'd be happy to. I have some indication of that because we do, as we adjust the demographic rates and say, okay, what did we pay you and how much were you over? We also make an adjustment on the risk-adjusted side. So, you know, I could certainly look at that. Our risk adjustment data, though, is our system is old. And with the move to new data, that's based entirely on health plan experience instead of a mix of health plan and fee-for-service data, and that has a new grouper, I would expect our ability to, the predictability of the risk adjustment to improve. That's my caveat on the risk adjusted side, that we were using old weights and old scores. We know that we need to adjust the base rate, and we do that on an annual basis. And as I say, the computers are even now producing numbers for us. We're trying to validate those numbers. We have them out of the system, but we haven't validated them yet.
We'll do one more question, and then we should probably move on.
Just a follow-up on the data request that Representative Huntley started. I know for the commercial or for the employed products, health plans provide a standard utilization report every year. And among other things, it has a nice page on it where it provides both the average per member per month cost, but it also gives you splits saying this following number of members use no care for the year, so many use between 1 and 500, 500 to 1,000. Now, and I forget what the particular splits are, but I find average costs sometimes horribly misleading because they don't really show you the spread of how care is being used. I mean, you can have a high cost, but it's actually a rather narrow spread you can have. And especially when you're comparing groups with very different demographics, I find that full-page report much more helpful than looking at average per member per month cost. So if these guys give you that, a similar report, that would be, I think, helpful.
Okay.
Do you?
Thank you very much. Julie,
good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the work group. My name is Julie Sonier. I'm director of the Health Economics Program at the Minnesota Department of Health. And I've been asked to speak to the committee today about the information that is available on healthcare providers' costs. And by this, we mean their costs of doing business, their costs of providing a specific service. And while it is relatively easy in some cases to find aggregated information on provider costs, so an example of this would be, what was a hospital's total operating expense over the course of the year? That information is very easy to find. It's much more difficult to find data on costs that providers actually incur to provide specific services. In my presentation today, I'll focus on a couple of areas where there is at least some information available about the average cost for providers to perform a specific service, and I'm going to draw mainly on information that Medicare uses to set its payment rates to do that. Existing payment systems, even Medicare's payment systems for different types of providers, vary substantially in the degree to which they are actually directly related to providers' cost of performing services. I should also probably warn you up front that I'm not an expert on Medicare payment policy, so I will try to answer the questions that you have. But mostly what I'll be trying to do is provide a high-level overview of how the payment system works and how provider costs enter into that. Some of the most detailed information that's available on provider costs comes from the way that Medicare pays for physician services. The physician fee schedule is called the Resource-Based Relative Value System, or RBRVS, and that was referred to in this morning's Healthcare Access Commission as well. This system's been in place since 1992. Within the system, there are three main components of Medicare payments for physician services. So first, there's a payment for the value of the physician's time and skills. Second, there's a payment for direct and indirect expenses that a physician's practice incurs to provide a service. And third, there's a payment for malpractice insurance expenses. In practice, the first two of these components each represent about half of the payment, and the malpractice component is very small, so I'm going to focus more on the first two than the third. There are also additional adjustments to payments that could be made for geography and for other factors, such as if a service is performed by a nurse practitioner rather than a physician. But to keep things simple, I'm just going to describe the payment system in terms of its three main components. It's important to note also that Most private payers base their own payments to physicians on some variant of Medicare's payment system. So to the degree that Medicare's fee schedules have some unintended effects, some of which I'll talk about in a few minutes, these would often carry through to other types of insurance as well. With regard to the first component of payment, which is the physician work component, and it's about half of the total payment, Medicare has established a relative value scale that rates the time, skill, effort, and stress involved in performing any specific type of services. So there is actually a list of several thousand distinct services, each of which is assigned its own relative value. So, for example, a procedure that is simple and quick would be rated much lower on this scale than something that is complicated and time-consuming. These relative values are updated by CMS every 5 years with input from an advisory committee of physicians. One concern that many people have raised about this system is that it tends to undervalue primary care. So, for example, a face-to-face visit with a physician to discuss management of an ongoing health problem compared to specialty care and procedures. A recent article published earlier this year in the Annals of Internal Medicine, which I believe has been distributed to the work group, detail some of the reasons why this seems to be the case and why it may be a concern for policymakers. So, for example, to the degree that increases in cost are being driven by higher volumes and reimbursement rates for specialty services, this actually has an impact on payments received by everyone in the system, including primary care physicians. The same article...
Can I just ask a question on that? And just to clarify, that relative value scale is based on a market survey of what doctors, physicians are charging?
Mr. Chair, the physician work component part of it is based on the judgment of a committee of physicians. So this is the advisory committee that makes recommendations to CMS about what adjustments should be made in that scale. So it's not based on charges. It's just based on what is it worth in terms of time and skill to do one thing versus another. So it's a pretty subjective judgment.
And then they have a baseline, and then they, for each different procedure, they have a multiplier it's a multiplier from a baseline.
That's correct.
And so it's the doctors that are basically saying, this is what we think we should be paid.
That's correct.
Okay.
Or the relative values of different services compared to each other.
If I could jump in there, Mr. Chair, and Dr. Wood was here this morning, and he many times has told us that he gets paid four times as much per hour to put a stent in somebody as he does spending an hour trying to prevent that person from needing a stent. And that's because to prevent that person from needing a stent is a face-to-face office visit. And the payment reward for that is not nearly as much as it is for actually doing a procedure, even though the one might actually be of more value.
Very fair point. Absolutely. That's what we got to get at. But I guess the other question I would have, so CMS takes this information. Do they have like a target of how much they want to spend, and then which would set kind of that base rate that they would multiply off of?
Mr. Chair, yes, they do. There is at the end, all of these relative values get added up and multiplied by a number that's called a conversion factor, but you can think of it as a base payment rate, and that number is supposed to be adjusted up and down depending on, for example, what previous cost increases are. So there is a target, but in the past several years, Congress has actually taken action. You may have, it generates a lot of media coverage when payments are scheduled to go down, and Congress has very often taken action to reverse those scheduled payment cuts. But that is exactly, there is a way built into the system to make sure that costs stay within a certain target.
And that is based on cost, or just CMS saying we want to reduce costs by 5% this year? Or do you know if they have any analysis that underlies that?
Mr. Chair, the conversion factor for the physician work component, as I understand it, isn't really based on cost, but it's sort of this value of your time. So it's not so much a cost as it is with some of the other things like the syringes and the office supplies and things like that that are directly measured.
And I was talking more about this baseline where they set the overall amount and then they've tried to reduce it as I assist the sustainability growth, whatever it is. Do you know if that's based on analytics analysis, or is it just kind of we need to put some cost controls in place, and so they pick a number?
Mr. Chair, I do know that the number that is the target growth rate is based on something, but I would have to get back to you as to what specifically that is. I don't believe it was just pulled out of thin air.
Okay, that would actually be helpful. Thank you. And okay. Go ahead.
The same article that I just mentioned briefly from the Annals of Internal Medicine also describes research evidence that shows that there's even larger disparities between payments to primary care and specialty care for people who are covered by private insurance. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but one clear contributor is the fact that private insurers actually have to negotiate with providers, whereas Medicare simply sets a fee schedule. So to the degree that providers have negotiating leverage, such as some specialty groups, they're often able to negotiate higher payment rates relative to primary care. So that gap between primary and specialty care is often larger in private insurance. The second major component of Medicare's physician payments is the practice expense component, and this is intended to pay for both the direct and the indirect costs of providing a service. The direct costs include things like clinical labor, supplies, and equipment that are needed to perform a particular service, and they're estimated separately for each of the thousands of different services in the physician fee schedule. I think there was a document distributed to the workgroup members titled Medicare Payment Overview that actually walks through a specific example of what the direct costs calculations are that go in, that how this is done for using the example of an electrocardiogram. The indirect costs include things like the cost of office space, administrative personnel, and other overhead costs. And again, this is all put into a relative value scale that rates the amount of resources needed for one type of services compared to other types of services. This slide is an illustration of how that actual payment for services is calculated. So essentially what you've got is you're adding up these relative value units for each of the three different components of the payment. Each of those is getting adjusted by a geographic factor. And then at the end, it's all multiplied by the conversion factor, which is the base payment currently, which is about $38, to determine the final payment. So in other words, the payment systems are built on information that does incorporate the actual costs of providing services, but there's many other adjustments that are made. So in the final payment, the connection between actual cost and actual payment is not a one-to-one connection. There are actually some reasons why you probably would not want to have a one-to-one connection between costs and provider payments. And the way that Medicare historically paid for hospital services is a good example of this. Prior to the...
Can I just to clarify, the references to documents that Ms. Sonier is making is stuff that was emailed to you. It's not in the packets, just so everybody's clear about that. Okay.
Prior to the time that the hospital prospective payment system was implemented for Medicare in 1984, payments for hospitals were actually based on historical costs. And a major criticism of this system of payment was that it provided no incentives for hospitals to be cost efficient. And it was also believed to be a major contributor at the time to a medical arms race for hospitals to invest in the latest technology. Currently, both inpatient and outpatient hospital care are paid for by Medicare under a prospective payment system, which means that the payment for a particular admission or a visit doesn't vary with the hospital's cost to actually provide the care. So the payment levels are determined based on a patient's diagnosis and their severity of illness, with the goal that hospitals will have an incentive to be more efficient if they don't get paid more for doing more. In the decade that followed the implementation of the hospital prospective payment system, and this is just for the inpatient side, the total number of hospital days provided declined by 20%, which many people believe was due to this incentive to use resources more efficiently.
Can I ask, do we know if hospitals actually got less money as a result of that, made less money?
We can look to find out. I'm not sure how much historical. In Minnesota, our data only goes back to 1987, but we can look and see if there's any national.
Okay. That'd be helpful. Thanks.
In addition to the system of prospective payment, there's a number of other special payments that Medicare makes to hospitals that are to further specific policy goals. So those are payments for things like medical education to offset the costs associated with providing care to a disproportionate share of low-income patients, payments to maintain geographic access to hospitals in rural areas, and other types of special payments. I just wanted to conclude by talking a little bit about some recent changes in Medicare's hospital payment policy. Since the inpatient prospective payment system was put in place, the payments have been based on hospitals' relative charges for different types of services. But to the degree that markups are higher for some types of services than others, basing payment rates on charges means that some types of services are going to end up being much more profitable than others. So beginning in the fall of 2006, CMS began to institute changes to the way that the hospital payments are calculated in order to move toward a system that is more based on provider costs than charges. And it's intended to reduce this variation in profitability by type of hospital services. And this is important because it's something that MDH found in a report to the legislature earlier this year is a potential driver of investment in medical facilities when you have competition for providers to get or retain market share in high-margin services. The changes to the payment system are also intended to improve the accuracy of payment rates by expanding the number of diagnosis codes to better account for the variation in severity illness. And these changes are to be phased in over a 3-year period. Hopefully this provides a high-level overview with useful information on payment systems. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions that the work group has.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did read all the stuff that got sent out, but I'm not sure that it helped me all that much. So could you explain for like the difference between cardiac care and mental health care? Everybody says that mental health doesn't get paid, gets paid below cost, and cardiac care gets paid above cost. Now, is part of that the relative value piece for the physician part? And then is there another piece within the hospital, for inpatient, let's just say, for the hospital piece that also overvalues the cardiac care over cost versus the mental health care?
With regard to that issue in particular, it's often talked about as an example. I've never seen any data that actually says this is how much we're overpaying cardiac care and this is how much we're underpaying mental health care. But it's believed, but I think you're getting at the heart of the issue, which is that cardiac care tends to be very high technology intensive, procedure intensive types of services, whereas mental health care is much more sort of evaluation and management and face-to-face types of things. Which provides good examples of the kinds of things that many people believe are sort of out of balance in current payment systems to the degree that they over-reward technology and procedures compared to face-to-face services.
Other questions? Okay, thank you. That's great. I think we're going to Jonathan, go next if you would. Go ahead. Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee, for allowing me to speak today on community health centers and some of our costs that we face. Just give you a quick overview, I think, to tell what a community health center is here. Looking at our patient demographics is the first way to tell our story. Some of the clinics you might be familiar with are in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, West Side, Open Cities, Fremont Community Health Services Clinic like those, and up in Lake Superior Community Health Services in Duluth. But just to look at our patient demographics, and that has a lot to do with our costs. On the left-hand side, chart one looks at just our percentage that have private insurance, and that's 15% are privately insured. Obviously, we serve a lot of uninsured and those folks on public programs. And I broke out that private chart slice of the pie, rather, and compared it to the general population of the state of Minnesota. So as you can infer from this, obviously, is that cost shifting is a very difficult thing to do at a community health center, whereas a traditional practice may be able to cost shift some of the shortfalls in reimbursement levels from other programs onto the private payers. That's really not an option entirely at a community health center. What, in terms of specific cost areas, I thought it was important to look at over time how they've changed at the community health centers in the state of Minnesota, and there are 18 of them throughout the state. You could see here in 2001, nearly two-thirds of our costs were in medical services and very small amounts in our mental health and pharmacy services. Fast forward 5 years, we've seen a dramatic growth in the mental health pharmacy and particularly in the enabling services. This is another hallmark of a community health center, our enabling services, and I'll get into this in a second. But as you can see, as a proportion of our total cost, medical's gone down, and our other sorts of services have really increased over time, just basically meeting the demand of our patients that we see. Dental services has pretty much flatlined or remained at the same proportion of services, percentage of cost of our services, rather. What this chart attempts to do is just explode out that enabling services piece, that 16% in 2006, in just more of the detail, because a lot of people ask, what exactly is it, enabling services? And I guess the first question is, why do you provide it? And oftentimes, it's not a cost that is reimbursed by health insurance of any sort, and it can be very costly, as this chart shows. In 2001, we provided about $2.6 million worth of enabling services. That grew dramatically to about $8.8 million by the year 2006. Some of the key services as enabling services, given the patient population we serve, especially by race and ethnicity, translation services obviously becoming more in demand, and case management, kind of the navigator approach to helping our patients, particularly those on a lower education scale, navigate the health system, which can be very complex at times. So we feel that there's savings achieved by investing in these sorts of resources for our patients in the end. Looking at the average annual change in cost per patient by our different cost areas from 2002 to 2006, you'll see, again, these enabling services increase at a rate nearly 10% a year. There's just such a demand for these services that we're spending more and more of our resources on that. Our medical services increase, I guess, only at a rate of about 4% on average per year, and just our basically general growth of costs across all services is about 6.3%. Again, you can take from this graph our enabling services really increasing on a per-patient basis. Moving on to chart six, and I thought this was interesting because people always look at how do you pay for these services, given our inability to cost shift and the patients that we serve. This is a cost versus revenue chart. On the left-hand side, that should say cost, actually, is the lighter shade of blue, and the darker shade of blue on the right-hand side of each one of these products is the amount of revenue we collected. And what first probably pops up for a lot of providers in the room is that these community health centers get nearly 79% of their costs for Medicaid patients. As some of you might know, we do receive what's called a prospective payment rate, which roughly approximates our costs for providing services to Medicaid patients. And the reason we get that, if you remember that first chart I showed you, we have 40% that are uninsured and 40% on Medicaid. We can't cost shift losses there. So Congress back in 1991, United States Congress, mandated that all community health centers in the United States be paid near their cost for Medicaid patients. What was occurring previously is some of the grants we used to serve the uninsured were being used to backfill our losses in the Medicaid program. Obviously, Congress was pretty excited when they heard that we were using dollars for uninsured to help Medicaid patients. So that's the reason we get near our costs on Medicaid. However, if you look at our other costs, our revenue relative to our costs, what really comes out is our uninsured, the self-pay. They're contributing nearly only about 20% to the cost of their care. We do this through a sliding fee schedule that takes into account their income and family size. That could be an enabling service when you think about it, because we're enabling folks to access a healthcare system. Those costs, again, as the general number of uninsured increase at our clinic, roughly 45% since 2001, those costs are skyrocketing as well.
Representative Thiessen?
Yes.
Just a clarification. So in the top part of the graph, you talk about costs, and then in the bottom part, you talk about charges and collected. Are the charges the same as the cost, or is...
No, that's a type error, Mr. Chair. Holly, it's a type error. That should say costs.
Okay.
Right. Instead of charges.
Exactly. I do have the charge data, but we charge a lot less than our cost given the patient population we serve. If an uninsured patient comes in and the doc knows that there's probably very little likelihood that this person's going to be able to pay for that service to the full extent, the charges are going to be a little bit lower. That's the reason.
Could I just do a follow-up? So when you figure costs, because I think this was sort of what the conversation before was trying to get to, so you actually figure what it really costs you, right? Like what the doctor gets paid, what the nurse gets paid, what the equipment gets paid. So it really, I mean, it would be similar to like what it costs to build a car as opposed to what we're kind of used to the conversation in like hospitals being, that's not really a cost exactly.
Right, Mr. Chair. Holly, what we do, we do have a report that is generated by each community health center that does look at their costs by each specific area, medical, mental health, dental, and it incorporates all the costs associated with providing those services. I can get that aggregate number for all of our community health centers, and I know what their aggregate charges are, so that's how I come up with that cost to charges ratio for our clinics. Does that answer your question? Okay. I think it's more of a reporting issue where we do have some sophisticated reporting for our federal, since we do receive federal grants, they're very interested in some of our financial numbers for the sustainability of the clinic, so we do have some good reports that we can hone in on that data.
Well, and just to follow, and that so when you say you get reimbursed from the federal on a prospective payment basis based on your costs, it's not on a procedure by procedure basis, but it's kind of on a clinic wide. This is the cost that we have incurred to do medical stuff in this clinic for this year.
Correct, Mr. Chair. For Medicaid and counter, for example, we have a prospective payment system rate, a PPS rate of, I think it averages maybe $120, and you know Westside Community Health Services is going to get theoretically $120. Fremont Community Health Services rate might be $110 for all their Medicaid encounters. That's how it works.
Okay.
Thanks. So moving on, this is national data. It is not Minnesota data, unfortunately, but our national association came out with a report this summer called Access Granted. And what I attempted to do here was they compared the mean medical expenditures for community health center users versus non-community health center users in 2004. And they broke the populations into different, they sliced it different ways. On the left-hand side, again, the lighter shade is a community health center, a user, their mean expenditure. And on the right-hand side, the darker shade is a non-community health center user. As you can see, for poor, not poor, for Medicaid, uninsured, and private, the mean medical expenditure is lower for the community health center versus user versus a non-community health center user. I think it's easier to pull off the data. If you look at the next table, it's basically the same data, but just not in a graphical depiction because it has the difference column on the right-hand side. Overall, this report concludes that it's $1,800 cheaper to use for a user to use a community health center rather than not a community health center. And these savings are from hospitalizations that are avoided, emergency department visits avoided, those sorts of things are where the cost savings are achieved. Particular interest probably to this group is the Medicaid line, where we save roughly $1,000 per user. Again, this is U.S. data. I suspect in just looking, bouncing back real quick, just looking at their mean medical expenditures per user, I know ours are significantly lower than that, but I suspect the relationship to a non-CHC user is probably similar. So we would achieve some savings. I'm in no position to quantify that. It takes a lot of research on that end.
Yeah, Representative Hunley.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Watson, so these charts you were just showing us include the cost of providing that service, but in your total, for instance, the non-CHC users, you're looking at their total expense, hospitalizations, non-hospitalizations.
Mr. Chair, Representative Holmes, that's correct.
Okay,
that's correct. Just to clarify, these just aren't the costs at the community health center.
Well, let me follow up.
That's because I got confused by that question.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So
the hospital costs would be included in here.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Do you have any data to show that the reduction in hospital costs is because you're doing a better job than the other side?
There is, Mr. Chair, Representative Hilly, about two slides. There's some literature that tends to suggest that. I don't have any Minnesota-specific data, but I do have some national data and some other states' data. Okay, keep going.
Thank you. So I have that clear then. When it says CHC user, the cost, that includes the cost if that person actually goes to the hospital, too. You're including that cost even though you're not directly providing the service.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. And again, that's reflective of these enabling services. You know, we get them in maybe potentially earlier and avoid some of those things. So.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. Moving on to slide 9, and hopefully, Representative Huntley, this answers some of your questions. These were some of the literature review. In Michigan, a study concluded that CHCs save nearly $45 per member per month in Medicaid spending. Getting, I think, directly to Representative Huntley's question, the second bullet point, they did a study in 4 states, and that those that use community health centers, Medicaid patients, they're 19% less likely to use emergency department and 11% less likely to be hospitalized for a ambulatory care-sensitive condition when they are compared to MA beneficiaries just of a regular office-based physician. And lastly, when you talk about chronic disease, particularly diabetes, a study in South Carolina concluded that the cost of the Medicaid program are $400 less per Medicaid patient that use CHCs. And again, fewer ED visits, hospitalizations, and we do have lower costs for lab services at our clinics as well.
Can I just ask one other?
Sure.
Oh, Representative Holley, did you have
a question? Mr. Chair, could you redefine, Mr. Watson, what ACS is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley.
Ambulatory something or other.
Ambulatory care sensitive condition, as I understand it, is, for instance, an asthmatic visit to the hospital. Something along those lines is how it was defined in this study. My lack of clinician training is really showing right now. But
okay. Okay, I'll ask mine after you're
okay.
Done here.
It's right here if anybody needs to.
You want
to
know about that.
All right. Moving on, I just think on slide 10, when we talk about costs, we try to talk about how effective our costs are. And there's been a lot of debate and discussion about what a medical home is in a few of these committees. And in my opinion, we've been a medical home since 1967 in Minnesota. We provide comprehensive services, dental, behavioral health, along with medical services. And I think that's a very cost-effective tool for particularly low-income populations that don't have a lot of time to take off of work. They can use these as one-stop shopping, if you will. Again, these enabling services, I'm harping on that a lot today, but I think they're effective for maintaining our relationships with patients. Again, they're not covered typically by insurance, and they're the highest cost increases we've seen over the last 5 years. We do have a team approach to eliminating healthcare disparities. The federal government has a lot of the clinics working on what are called health disparities collaboratives, where we're trying to eliminate disparities for some of the chronic diseases, diabetes and asthma, just a different approach to delivering medical care, and those have different costs, if you will. And then obviously I want to talk about challenges to cost from a community health center perspective, a nonprofit. A lot of discussion about implementing health records in terms of achieving savings, and they come with a pretty severe cost to community health centers that really operate on the margin, just to keep that in mind. One of the main cost challenges we have, too, is recruiting physicians. As we talked about earlier today, the lack of primary care providers coming out. And granted, the primary care providers have a lower salary relative to specialists, but the ones at community health centers even have lower salaries still yet. So it's very hard to recruit folks, and there's an opportunity cost to that when we have vacancies at health centers. Those that come to us as private insurance come with very high deductibles. In reality, they're uninsured when they see us because we have to provide discounts some of their care. Their insurance isn't kicking in yet because of the deductible. The discussion earlier about the differing pay for performance, I have a chart that looks at all the different reporting that community health centers have to do by whether it be the city of Minneapolis contract that some of them have, the Q Care, the Medica, all the different health plans, and it's, as you can see, the chart has X's in different rows than the others. That comes at a, just like all providers, comes at a cost. So some standardization uniformity that would really help us bring down some of our costs. And again, to close the gap on some of our financial costs, you looked at some of those charts earlier, you ask, how do you survive? Well, obviously, we rely a lot on grants and private foundations, so that comes at a cost, too, to the health center employing those folks on staff. So I believe that is my entire presentation, if you have any questions.
Senator Berger.
The first question that I have is how many of the community health centers are applying for the assistance that the state is now providing for implementing electronic medical records?
Off the top, Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, off the top of my head, I've gone out to, since legislative sessions conclude, I've done some trainings and updates at the board meetings of our community health centers, and the five that have gone to all, I think four out of the five have applied for assistance under the e-health loans and grants. And it was a welcome change because I think how the legislation was originally crafted, their individual clinics couldn't apply or were prohibited from applying, but a change late in the session really helped the community health centers to access those funds. But I don't know the total number, and I can get those for you.
My advice is they should all be applying.
Absolutely.
And then the other thing I wanted to ask is we had a presentation this morning to the full Healthcare Access Commission about one of the other working groups that are working on the issue of medical home. And one of the barriers to implementing a medical home for everyone is access to providers. And so I'm just wondering, how do you actually manage to recruit, and do you have to be certified by the federal government in order to be located in a new place? For instance, if we had an access issue someplace in Minnesota, if we were going to look to a community health center to fill that void, would you have to be certified by the federal government in order to be able to operate?
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, you're correct. To have a community health center in an area of the state, it has to be designated as a medically underserved area. And I think there's ample spread of medically underserved areas across the state, and I think some of those problems where you're having issues with finding physicians, or odds are they are going to be a medically underserved area. Unfortunately, President Bush, in the last 7-8 years, however long it's been, has attempted to double the number of community health centers nationwide, and he's done a great job of that, except in Minnesota. We rank, I think, 49th out of 50 states in getting new money, federal money, under his initiative into the state. A lot of the money went into Texas. I couldn't quite figure that one out. But if you want to help me out with that, I'd appreciate it. So a lot of the – starting a community health center in some of these communities, we've been trying to do it for 6 years now. We've worked with over 7 communities, and they just do not score well on the federal program. Our population in the rural areas is too white. We have babies that weigh too much, and we live too long. And when we're compared to Mississippi and Alabama, it's very hard to start a community health center. So to answer your second question, I guess, there is the issues out there for medically underserved areas. It's just a problem of starting them with federal money. A lot of states do have what's called a state-qualified health center, where the state finally became frustrated and said, we're just going to start our own program that replicates the federal program, but have it on a state level with state money.
So it is possible to do that?
It is possible, absolutely. And one of the advantages Community Health Center has is we're able to apply for state loan repayment programs from the state of Minnesota, as well as the National Health Service Corps is one of the perks, if you will, of Community Health Centers, where they provide scholarship and loan repayment to folks that agree to serve in underserved areas at Community Health Centers.
And last question then. Would it be possible for you, A, to get us information about the communities you've been trying to get new clinics started in, and B, would it be possible for you to get us information about what those startup costs are?
Ms. Chair, yes, absolutely, I can do that.
And just to clarify, and then I know Holly has a question as well, even do the state-qualified centers qualify for those other federal perks, like the loan repayment and all that stuff, or do they have to be in the federal program?
Ms. Chair, no, they do not qualify.
Okay.
For, like, Indiana has a state-qualified health center program. They don't get the benefits of the federal.
Like the scholarships.
Exactly,
okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you know, I don't know if the scholarships support when they did the comparison to the U.S. to the other international, other countries, and basically concluded that price is the reason why we spend so much more than any other country. And what I'm curious about in terms of your cost comparison and your comment about the fact that you can't pay physicians market rate,
is the difference in the costs, do you have a sense of whether the difference in the cost is really about the input prices like that, or do you actually, I mean, it seems like you're set up to actually provide more efficient services, but I'm just wondering if you have a sense of those savings. How much is the fact that you pay your doctors 75% of what another doctor gets paid, and how much of it is that you actually run a just more efficient program with better outcomes and less costs?
Mr. Chair, I think part of that, I agree with all those things that you mentioned are part of the equation, but the one piece that's missing from that equation is the capital. These businesses aren't very highly capitalized businesses. Of our 18 community health centers, only two in the 11 years I've been with the association have done any major renovation or new building. So while they're saving money by not having a lot of debt and capital on their books, they're also operating sometimes in a horribly, well, not horribly, but they could operate a little more efficiently if they had new building, new equipment, and those sorts of things. So it's the salaries, it's the efficiency, and it's the lack of, I guess, capital debt that keeps our costs down.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jonathan, I think I heard you say it this way, but do you think we've maximized our opportunity as far as current federal law is to get more community health centers? Would it require changes in those federal requirements to loosen up so that Minnesota would be in a position to get more dollars?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Zimmerman, I believe that I think the window is shut, essentially. I think this was, I'm not trying to be political here whatsoever, but I think community health centers are championed by Republicans more because it's not viewed necessarily as an entitlement, yet they, in their mind, thinks it meets the obligations of the underserved. And I also think that community health centers have done very well in the appropriations process over the last 6 years. And there's a lot of other programs that have been flatlined or zeroed out, in a sense, that are waiting for their turn at the trough, if you will. So just my personal opinion, and I don't think it makes that big of a difference in terms of the who becomes our next president. I don't think there's going to be an opportunity for federal investment to the degree there has been in the last 6-7 years.
Thank you.
Actually, Representative, are you all right? Representative Hulley.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Watson, could you refresh my, I used to know this, but how many community clinics are there and how many of those are the federally qualified ones? And have any of them closed recently? I heard about Minneapolis losing two or three. Yeah.
Our membership consists of 18, Mr. Chair, Representative Henley, our membership consists of 18 community health centers, and they deliver services at about 54 different sites.
Okay.
So a couple of what you're referring to, the closures were, for example, Westside Community Health Services, they shut down their La Clinica site, one of their 7 sites, and I believe Hennepin County actually took over that site. Also, a site up in Moorhead shut down as well. So we have different sites closing down, while at the same time we did get a new community health center started in Mankato. Unfortunately, they don't get the federal grant, but they get some of the benefits. So we've kind of gained one and lost two, if you will. And in terms of services, too, I know given the crunch in terms of finances, a lot of the clinics shut down these enabling services because they're such a high cost, and they're not mandated to do it. So that's the first place they look at. And a lot of the $3 million that you passed last session are going to go to expand those services.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Watson, let me, this one's kind of pulled out of the air here, but do you have any data on, I mean, you had these cost data of your patients versus patients that show up at a regular hospital or emergency room, whatever. Do you have any data on low birth weight babies for your clients versus similar?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lee, I do actually have some perinatal data information at my, I thought it was at my fingertips. Yes, it is here, but I don't have the comparison to state level data, and I could certainly put together something for you that compares those. So,
yeah, because the reason I'm asking is particularly amongst minority young women, we have probably the worst rate in the country, and a lot of these kids are called $1 million babies, and a lot of that low birth weight stuff would be prevented by some of your enabling type of thing rather than the actual
Mr.
medical
Chair,
care they get.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Helling, just look at this report right here, for example, for African Americans, the percentage that have a birth weight below 2,500 grams, which is considered low, is 70%. So we do have the who are coming into our clinics obviously are facing some significant barriers to care. And one of the statistics on here that I can't glean off here right now is just when they came to us in terms of first, second, or third trimester. And I believe looking at it, it was pretty late in the game. So some of our enabling services, frankly, aren't doing the job. We need to keep doing more, and that's why you see that huge cost increase. Our clinics recognize that, and they're trying to get these folks into the fold, if you will.
Okay, if you could send me that
Absolutely.
Data, I'd appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Do you have a question? No? Any other questions? One other piece of information, I don't know if you have it, but in terms of utilization of services or intensity of services, do you have any comparisons between your groups and in general data?
I do have encounters per patient for the different medical, dental, and mental health, and I wouldn't even know where to go to begin. Maybe I should talk to Ms. Sonia or somebody at the department to figure out where to get it for the state, you know, in terms of comparison. But I can give you community health center data on that for sure.
Thanks.
I will do that.
Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you.
We're going to move on to the last thing. The one other piece of this that at some point would be interesting to me, and we don't have to do it in this group, but is to get the perspective on this cost issue to the extent we can from the health plan side of things, so maybe we can talk about that a little bit more as we go forward. Mr. Godfrey.
Yes. Mr. Chair, working group members, in your package should be a handout of slides that is a presentation that Dr. Lynn Blewett from the University of Minnesota State Health Access Data Assistance Center presented to the full Healthcare Access Commission on September 5th. And I've been asked to just summarize her presentation for your benefit if you didn't see it at that particular meeting. And so what I'll do is I'll try to go through this fairly quickly, and we'll probably skip a number of slides, but stop me along the way if you have any questions. The first slide really begins with just some general points that Dr. Blue is making about uncompensated care, that there is a relationship that I think most people are familiar with between increasing number of uninsured and increasing levels of uncompensated care. And conversely, there's a relationship that goes the other way, which is increases in coverage leads to decreases in uncompensated care. She notes that hospitals provide most of the free care to the uninsured, and that hospitals and other providers make up losses as a result of uncompensated care by cost shifting. Then on the next page, she lays out a policy framework, which kind of guides the study that we'll talk about in a moment. But essentially, increasing health insurance coverage will lead to decreases in levels of uncompensated care. Less uncompensated care means more revenue for providers. And more revenue means uncompensated care savings can be passed along to consumers in terms of lower premiums. She defines uncompensated care as a combination of charity care plus bad debt, and then states that there's a relationship between this relationship between uncompensated care and health increase in health care coverage has policy applications, and she notes specifically Minnesota Care and the Maine Dorrigo health care program. In Minnesota Care, the idea that expansion leads to decreases in uncompensated care was used as a rationale in part to enact the 2% provider tax. And those funds, of course, today are deposited in the Healthcare Access Fund. And the use of Minnesota Care, she notes, providers were to benefit from more people being covered by health insurance. And the provider tax is a mechanism to recover a portion of the benefit to providers for reduced uncompensated care costs. Then we'll skip the two slides on the Maine program. And just on page 5, she just notes the research questions that her study looks at, which is, can a direct link be established between decreases in uncompensated care and increases in public program enrollment? holding other factors constant, and can one demonstrate this link with state-specific data? And then we get into her research paper, which is hospital provision of uncompensated care and public program enrollment. The year she looks at is between 1992 and 97, and she looks at Minnesota care enrollment and also hospital levels of uncompensated care at the aggregate county level, and then also looks at county level economic and demographic indicators as part of her multivariate analysis. The next slide just shows what the level of, eligibility levels were in Minnesota care during various times in the study period. The next two charts on page 7, I think, really show the point that she's trying to evaluate here, which is you can see in the first chart, the average monthly enrollment of Minnesota care is increasing over this time period. And we also see over the same time period a decrease in uncompensated care costs. So then she uses a multivariate analysis to determine whether this relationship is statistically significant. And in the analysis, she controls for hospital characteristics and county population characteristics, which are noted there. And the results of the study found that, yes, there was a statistically significant relationship between uncompensated care and increased expansion of Minnesota care enrollment. And it was negative, meaning that while there was an increase in enrollment, there was a decreasing amount of uncompensated care. And she found that the savings, or basically the relationship is 1% increase in Minnesota care enrollment led to a decrease in uncompensated care cost per capita of $2.19. When you look at that altogether over a five-year period, she found that $58.6 million was saved in uncompensated care costs to Minnesota hospitals. And then you can see that graphically on page 9. Over that time period of study, the first line that you'll see in that chart is what would have been the uncompensated care costs without Minnesota care versus the bottom line, which is what the uncompensated care costs were. And the conclusions of the study are essentially that it provides a policy rationale for increased expansions by reducing levels of uncompensated care. Benefits in our analysis are limited to hospitals, but there's other savings in uncompensated care costs. Later on, there's a chart that shows that about 37% of all uncompensated care costs are in a physician or clinic setting. So there's also savings to be derived there. And then benefits in reduced levels of uncompensated care exceeded Minnesota care expenditure for hospital care, at least in the initial years.
David, Mr. Godfrey, just to clarify on this, the 1% increase in the cost of that to the state may actually be more than do we have any comparison to what that, or the saves $2.19 per capita? Do we know what the cost of the state versus the savings in uncompensated care? I mean, I know part of this is just to recapture that to maybe pay a portion of it, but do we know what the relationship is? Was that addressed in the study?
Yes, Mr. Chair, it was addressed in the study. The study is in my office, unfortunately, but we do have that information, and I can get that to the members. And then finally,
Do you know what the answer is? It more or less? Do you know?
My understanding, having read the study, is that in the early years with the initial expansion or the initial enrollment or start of Minnesota care, the costs or the savings from uncompensated care decrease was greater than the cost of the enrollment. But then as Minnesota care expanded and increased its enrollment, the actual cost of the program was greater than the savings realized in uncompensated care.
Okay, thanks.
The next section is some additional kind of update on trends since 96 or 98 since the study was completed. And it just simply shows, you can see, for instance, on page 13, there's the increase and uncompensated care hospitals, uncompensated care in Minnesota hospitals since 2001. And then I just also point out on page 15 is the chart that shows, the pie chart that shows the sources of uncompensated care costs by provider type, with 63% of those being hospitals. And also, just to note that there's, I believe, some web links here. Also, you can go to their website that's on the last page and find the study there if you don't have it. And also mentions that there's going to be a new healthcare access survey that's being conducted by the Minnesota Department of Health and the University of Minnesota, and that from that data they plan on updating these estimates.
Holly.
I was interested in the chart on page 13 where it breaks out how much of the uncompensated care is from charity care versus bad debt. Because I think what's important for us all to keep in mind as we think about either benefit sets or plan design or whatever going forward, that a lot of the bad debt that hospitals are now incurring are directly related to the cost shift in deductibles, co-pays, and co-insurance within the plan designs to individuals. So it's and if we're looking at lowering the entire uncompensated care load as opposed to just dealing with the charity care piece, I think we just need to be aware of that, because we don't want to add to the bad debt side of things, even though we're taking care of those sort of uninsured charity care segments in terms of plan design and such.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted David to present this to us. I did not want to keep asking Lynn Blewett to come back, because she's been quite generous with her time already. But I just wanted this to be presented so that we could understand a little bit that the cost of insuring the uninsured is not entirely a cost, that there would be some offsetting savings. And we need to keep that in mind as we proceed.
Mr. Chair, two questions, please. Okay, I understand the definition of uncompensated care, but do we know how it was measured? For instance, was this self-report, or was there some effort actually to tabulate the services?
Mr. Chair, working group members, actually, I'm not sure I can answer that question. I think that there is data on a statewide basis. I know that the Hospital Association keeps, and that might have been part of it. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if the Department of Health keeps similar information, but
Julie,
I could check on that.
And then my second question. On page 17, 16 and 17, there's slides about cost shifting. Were there efforts in the study to look at cost shifting at the time the study was done? Do you know?
Mr. Chair, I believe it was part of the discussion in the study itself. I can't really answer too much about that. I mean, I'd have to look into it.
And that's okay. If I may, then there's a comment sort of to tie the questions together. Back to the second slide about hospitals and other providers making up the loss for the uncompensated care. I think if we think back to the earlier presentations today, to the extent that providers cannot meet costs either through Medicaid or Medicare programs, there's some of that cost shifting too besides uncompensated care. And if we at some point talked about the health plan costs, I think it would be insightful to see the extent to which that cost shifting occurs and is borne by the commercial market.
Mr. Chairman, I have one comment about that, however, and that is that while it may initially show up only in the commercial market, it does come back to hit the state programs as well, because they look at medical trend in terms of what they should be negotiating in terms of increases in their health plan contracts. So it's like there's nobody left behind. The increased costs bring everybody with them. I mean, I believe that. It's just a matter of degree, whether you're hanging on to the mane of the horse or the tail of the horse. The horse is racing too fast, and everybody's got to go with it. And I would just also like to mention that since our uninsured have been going up in Minnesota, we have seen a correlating increase in uncompensated care going up. And so that's another thing for us to keep in mind as we look at how to address this concern.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I would just agree with that. I think we saw directly at Regions in 2004 after the coverage was cut in 2003 about an $11 million increase in uncompensated care just that first year. So there is a direct correlation there.
Okay, do you want to go on to the next? Yeah, we can pass this out. Or hand it, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, working group members, right now is a handout being passed out that'll look familiar. This is going back to the discussion that the working group had during the last meeting about trying to look at different premium levels for Minnesota Care under the scenario in which Minnesota Care would be expanded to 300% of poverty. And at that time, I had presented one scenario which had the premiums ranging in terms of percent of income from 1.8% to 9.6%, and then the working group had some discussion about that and was interested in looking at lower maybe premium levels overall as a percent of income. And so what you have here on the following pages is just different scenarios, beginning with a 5% maximum premium as percent of income. That ranges from 1.1% to 5%. Then another one that's at 6%, beginning at 1.2%. And then a 7% scenario that begins at 1.4%. And then a 8% scenario that begins at 1.6%. This just gives you an idea of what those premiums would look like in terms of dollar amounts relative to the percent of income. And what I attempted to do here was basically mirror the current premium schedule in terms of where the what the rate of increase was within the current premium schedule, meaning that proportionally it should be pretty close to the same within the schedule in the different scenarios as it is, I mean, similar to the current premium schedule. It doesn't have to be that way, but that was, I felt like, at least the best way to at least begin trying to set up what these schedules might look like. We've been in communication with the department about the possibility of getting these fiscal noted out to see what these premium schedules would cost in Minnesota Care with an expansion to 300%. Right now, and I think you'll probably hear a little bit more about this in the next week or so, right now, in terms of a timeline from DHS for completing fiscal notes, we're told, because they're in the middle of a forecast, we're putting together the forecast, that they won't really be able to turn their attention to most of the fiscal note work until middle of October. And so what we wanted to do here was just to present this to you and I guess see if there's an interest in going forward with these getting these scenarios fiscal noted out.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Berglund.
What DHS has told us is they don't want to guess when they do a fiscal note on where we would break the cost sharing within a 5% cap. They want us to tell them where we would break it. So this is an attempt to do that. And if you agree with this way of breaking it up, then this is what we would send them to do their cost analysis on.
And I think we probably want to take some official action, at least a general consensus, that this is what the committee would like DHS to at least get some numbers for us on. I mean, it basically gives us a variety of scenarios from 5 to 9.6% and see what the cost to the state of those different scenarios under a Minnesota Care model would be, right? Mm-hmm. Any discussion on that? Why don't we vote on it? How about that? On approving this is something that we would like DHS to come back to us with some actual numbers on. So everybody in favor of that, say aye.
Also move.
Thank you. Everybody in favor of that, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? All right. That motion's adopted. It's been a while. So, thank you. Thank you for putting that together. The last thing, I handed out a sheet that John Walls, our fiscal person in the House, put together. I think it's from revenue that breaks out in a variety of ways the number of households that fall into various income groups, just another piece of information as we think through affordability issues and other issues. So that's more just for reference going forward.
Mr. Chairman, maybe since you'll probably be taking these with you, this last thing we just voted on, you can be very cognizant of the difference in the cutoff at 300% in terms of the amount of subsidy versus the full premium. So, for instance, if you're going to go to a 5% cap on out-of-pocket costs up to 300% of poverty, for a family of three, for example, the premium they would be paying is $215 a month. The actual cost of that service would be $1,050 per month. So you can see that the subsidies are very great, and we need to also be thinking about sort of the cliff that creates for people when they move off of a subsidized product.
Yeah. Any other questions? So we're coming back next week, right? Next Wednesday. Well, we'll see what, yeah, Tom, Representative Huntley.
Paul. When the department does this, are they going to assume? How are they going to assume how many people are enrolled?
We're asking them to do it two ways. We're asking them to do it based on current eligibility, and we're asking them to do it based on a universal coverage assumption. Because we don't want them. We don't want to have to ask them to do it over again later. So we would have two different scenarios. And if you expanded eligibility somewhere in between, then you could use the model that you had gotten there to assume what the additional cost would be.
Yeah, I'm just wondering about, actually David and I were talking about this, but there's that group of people that already have insurance and are probably sick, so they get insurance and they really can't afford it. And if this is available, are they going to drop
it? Well, it doesn't change the rules of Minnesota Care.
Okay.
That Minnesota Care, under the fiscal notes that they would be doing, would still, people could not have employer-based coverage.
But universal coverage would mean every person under 300% of poverty in the state.
Who did not have employer-based coverage.
All right, okay.
Would be eligible to be covered.
So it'd pick up the gap. All right. Thank you. All right. Nothing else for adjourned. Thank you, everybody.